we're really focused on the net after-tax returns for our investors, right? If I'm going to hit a big IRR, that's great. But if it's in a tax-inefficient manner, and I really haven't provided them, you know, if that dollar turns into $1.25 after taxes and fees, I'm not really, in my opinion, being a fiduciary for folks.
Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings, the number one show about growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. Now, here's your host, Mark Allen Kenny.
Hey everybody, welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings. I'm Mark Allen Kenny. Our guest today is Brian C. Adams. How are you doing today, Brian?
Hey, good morning. I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Brian is the president and founder of Excelsior Capital, where he spearheads the investor relations and capital markets arm of the firm. He has 10 years of experience in real estate private equity and has advanced knowledge and best practices for strategic real estate investing. Brian, I'm super excited to have you on the show today. Could you tell the listeners just a little bit more about your background and how you got started in real estate?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you again for having me. So quick background on me. I'm originally from upstate New York, went to college in Connecticut where I met my wife, who is a native Nashvillean. So we both went to grad school in Boston. I went to law school up there and then moved to Nashville about 15 years ago. My wife's family has a single family office, which is essentially an investment entity purely for the benefit of our family members. So I frankly didn't have any background in private equity or commercial real estate until I joined the family. But as an ex officio board member, I got to come in contact with a lot of the sponsors and GPs that we were working with in the commercial real estate space and just kind of learn the business by being an investor through being a limited partner for the most part. I connected with my now business partner, who's also a New York guy that married a Nashville girl. We started our company 10 years ago. Start out raising blind pool commingled fund vehicles from friends and family. Started in Nashville and then grew that geographic footprint over the successive years. And at this point, we have probably a gross portfolio value of roughly $375 million. We're in 12 markets, secondary growth markets in the Midwest and the Southeast for the most part. We are commercial oriented. And we focus on capital preservation, yield, and then all those tax benefits that come from direct real estate ownership. At this point, we're only raising on a deal-by-deal basis from a network of individuals and families, but we only work with taxable investors, so no institutional LPs. And so, you know, that's a very quick summation of who I am and what we do.
Okay, awesome. So you're raising money for your own deals and you're in 12 markets. How do you choose your markets?
Yeah, so we're trying to solve for a cash on cash yield.
Okay.
And so we're very passive income oriented. And in order to do that, we are cap rate driven in terms of the type of product that we need to buy. So we're trying to solve for something like an 8% cash on cash yield annually. In order to do that, without taking on too much leverage or risk, I need to be buying things at, you know, a 7 to 9 cap, depending on kind of where we are.
Sure.
And so due to that and our size constraint, we like to be in that, call it $5 to $20 million purchase price. Once you kind of put all that together, you're looking at growth secondary markets. So when I say a secondary market, I'm looking at an MSA or a metropolitan area that has roughly 1 million or more people. Now, MSAs can be a squishy term, right? It could entail a large geographic region, or it could be a submarket depending on where you are. So once we kind of drill down into that population, we like to be 1 million plus MSA, but not in the top 10 gateway coastal markets. So we won't go to a place like LA or Seattle or New York or Chicago. Too much competition, cap rates are too tough, and it's just a difficult place for us to solve for our yield. And so we're in markets like Richmond, Virginia, Cincinnati, Tampa Bay, Raleigh, Nashville, Kansas City. We've started looking at Fort Worth, which is a submarket within the DFW Metroplex. So that's how we kind of look at MSAs and find markets. But for us, it's really important that we drill down to the submarket level. So as you know, a lot of these MSAs, if they don't have geophysical barriers, especially in the Midwest and the Southeast, they can sprawl pretty dramatically, which means that the difference between buying a commercial building in downtown Nashville versus 45 minutes outside of Nashville in a place like Cool Springs or Franklin is really, you know, the difference of the Atlantic Ocean. It's just a huge differential there. And so we drill down to submarkets or pocket neighborhoods that never experienced more than, call it a 12 to 14% vacancy during the downturn, that they don't have a lot of new speculative construction happening. Real rents today probably won't justify any type of new construction activity, so you feel very protected as a landlord. Now, you might miss out on some growth if you were to go to a place like an Austin, Texas or something, but at the same time, we are much more defensive posture oriented, so we feel more comfortable there. So once we kind of put all that data into a matrix, it spits out, you know, 5 to 10 markets that we need to keep an eye on, and we reassess every quarter. We're always cycling in and out of markets just due to pricing, right? So Nashville used to be a place that we owned a lot. Now we can't afford to buy anything there. And so we'll move on to a new place we find attractive. So that's probably a long answer to your question, but that's how we kind of target areas and target submarkets.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you for sharing that. So are you guys running those deals yourselves, or do you kind of partner with an operator that's boots on the ground? Because 12 markets, that's a lot for one firm. So what's your strategy for running those projects?
Yeah, so we are the operator sponsor ourselves. We source the deal, we run the deal, and we raise capital around that deal. We are the GP. So the way that we would focus on it is once we find a market that we find attractive, we try to gain scale there. So we'll try to get to 250,000 plus square feet over the course of 1 to 3 years by making multiple acquisitions. So then once we have enough momentum and scale in that marketplace, it's much more easier to manage as opposed to just doing a one-off deal. But we do have 15 employees, so we are able to kind of handle the asset management side of it. But we third-party lease and property manage. So when we go to a market, we'll work with a CBRE or a Cushman or JLL to handle the day-to-day as well as the leasing. We just don't have the scale to do vertically integrated management. And frankly, I think in my experience, it can be a very positive thing, but it's also very difficult to fire yourself for doing a bad job. And so I like to be able to keep it third-party, keep them responsible, and also if we need to make a change in that market, we can go to a different service provider and hopefully, you know, turn things around if they need to be done.
Awesome. So I'd love to learn a little bit more about the structure. You know, it's a very interesting story, just your background and then meeting your wife and learning about the family office space. Do you find, because a lot of the people that I interview on the show, they're doing syndications, they're raising 25K at a time, some of them. Do you find that if you're working with family offices, maybe someone's writing a much bigger check than some other syndicators, do you find that affects the deal structure? Are you doing just a simple syndication model? Are you doing joint ventures as well? What kind of structure do you prefer and find works well for your investors?
Yeah, it's a good question. We are pure play syndicators. So we try to keep, and I'm going to use some Wall Street jargon here, and so just bear with me, but we try to keep the capital stack, which is kind of the amount of equity and the debt that you have in the deal, how it all works together. We try to keep it very clean, right? So everyone who's an investor is pari passu, which means that they're all treated the same. Nobody has special rights or special control provisions or special economics. So everyone is common equity. We only do senior secured debt. So we're not going out there and getting preferred equity or mezzanine debt and really complicating that kind of return structure and return profile.
Sure.
And treating other parties differently. That being said, we do have some relationships with some larger families that they want to be the majority equity. And because of that, I think rightfully so, they want some control rights or oversight mechanisms, et cetera. And so in those scenarios, we're able to structure things that make sense for them and for us. But we typically don't bring in other investors into those deals because you are treating two parties differently, or at least you're disclosing it very fully on the front end so that everyone understands that, hey, I am the GP, I'm running this deal, but there's this person who's investing 95% of the equity. They also have veto rights, oversight rights, control rights over when we refinance the property, when we sell the property, when we make an expenditure over X amount of dollars, when we decide to do a lease, et cetera. You know, typically those are the two ways we do it. But for the most part, we treat everyone the same. And it's just a simple specialty purpose vehicle entity LLC.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's interesting. So the second example where someone has that oversight and can decide on a refi or sale, is that still structured as a syndication, as, you know, 506C, or is it become a joint venture at that point?
Yeah, I mean, these are all Reg D offerings. And so it really, you know, for us, it doesn't really matter if you're a qualified purchaser or an accredited investor. As long as you hit that AI status, we're still filing under Reg D exemption.
Got it. Awesome. And then for the equity itself, what made you guys decide to kind of stay away from institutional funds and things like that and stick with more individuals?
Life's too short to work with jerks. And I get it. And I've kind of gone back and forth with other groups about this. And these institutional investors that want to, you know, allocate to you, it's a great turnkey solution for some people. In my opinion, that capital is really expensive, both from an economic perspective and also just an emotional, mental perspective. So I'd be very cautious about how you enter into those. I've just myself experienced where, you know, they're going to be very focused on hitting their IRR and getting their carry and getting out.
Sure.
If the asset's performing well and it's producing good, stable cash income, they really don't care. It's almost, you know, once they hit their 3-year limit, they want to exit, regardless of what you want to do. And you're really working for them. And I think the trap that some people get into, which is maybe beyond your initial question, but I think important to talk about, is when you think about, if you're an aspiring sponsor or a GP or a syndicator, and one day you want to raise a big fund, right? So you want discretionary capital, you want to live in that world. These JV arrangements with these allocator groups are going to, for the most part, prevent you from ever doing that. One, because if you're talented and good, they want to continue to make money on you. And two, why would they allow you to grow to a scale where you would be a competitor for them with their fundraising partners? And so it's really not their interest to ever let you expand and grow. So it's a little bit of a gilded cage, in my opinion, where there's a lot of zeros there and they can write a big check. But I think ultimately you're no longer running your company. So it does work for a certain style of investments, depending on your end game. But I think if you're in this syndication world for, you know, financial freedom or flexibility or any of the other reasons that people leave corporate life, I don't think that's a great solution for a lot of people long-term.
Yeah. I appreciate that. That's very insightful. Let's talk about your structure a little bit. And I agree, a lot of times when you syndicate and you've got people trying to hit their IRR targets, you know, sometimes you have to make an exit in order to hit those returns. So it sounds like you're focused more on that 8% cash on cash, you know, maybe C-class, B-class properties. Could you speak to kind of your strategy and a typical hold period and things like that?
Yeah. So again, most of my investors want that monthly dividend check, right? They want that coupon. They want passive income to replace their fixed income portfolio, which has been underperforming for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And commercial real estate is a great alternative for that. So the way that I look at it is, unless I'm going to hit a really big multiple on invested capital, right? I'm going to take a dollar and give them two. For the most part, these folks would rather just continue to get that dividend and coupon than they would their original capital back, because they may not have anywhere productive to put that money right now, especially, I don't know when this episode is going to drop, but I mean, the market's going parabolic right now. And, you know, there's a lot of good news priced in, and they probably don't want to put more allocation towards the market. The fixed income and the bond markets are not going to achieve what they need. And so importantly, and where, again, I think there's a differential between doing a joint venture with an institutional group and working with taxable investors, we're really focused on the net after-tax returns for our investors, right? If I'm going to hit a big IRR, that's great. But if it's in a tax inefficient manner, and I really haven't provided them, you know, if that dollar turns into $1.25 after taxes and fees, I'm not really, in my opinion, being a fiduciary for folks. And so that's where just being really transparent on the front end, you know, it's difficult as a sponsor and operator because you oftentimes want to just make sure you close out that investor and get the deal done. But I promise you, it's much better to just be transparent and say, listen, this is going to be a 10-year hold. If you don't feel comfortable with your dollar being gone for 10 years, this is not the right deal for you. And I'm not the right group to work with. But these are the things that we will do. And that was a big lesson learned for me.
Yeah, yeah. I appreciate that. I think I've got a similar mindset. Are you guys, especially on the deals where you have one LP partner, are you leveraging things like 1031 exchanges and other, you know, tax strategies?
Yeah, so certainly organize things as a DST to take advantage of 1031. We've looked into the 1042 section for ESOPs, founders who are exiting their companies. And then obviously we work with folks who have self-directed IRAs or 401ks, et cetera. So yeah, we're open to all of that flexibility in terms of, you know, how folks want to, what vehicle they want to use to invest.
Sure, sure. Could you speak to some of the just tax advantages of direct real estate ownership? I mean, what's kind of most important you find to your investor base?
Yeah, and this was a mistake I made early on in my career. We would outsource this or third party it for bookkeeping and accounting and controller. And it, you know, it was cutting off my nose despite my face. So 2 years ago, year and a half ago, I hired a CPA with a public accounting tax background to be our in-house controller. Now, he can't give tax advice to people, but he can liaison very closely with our third-party tax partners to make sure that we are taking full advantage of every opportunity within the tax code. And I think one of the most powerful things is under the Trump Tax Act, you know, utilizing cost segregation analysis to do accelerated depreciation, especially for multi-tenant office buildings, is just incredible. I mean, I can't promise anything, but oftentimes we're able to show a loss in year one, two, and maybe three of your hold period so that even though you're getting 10% cash on cash annually, your K-1 is showing a loss and you could offset gains elsewhere in your portfolio. And for taxable investors, especially high income earners, it's an incredibly useful tool. And so that's one of the things that we're very focused on.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. We had Yonah Wise on the show and he kind of walked us through that strategy. And I think that's a huge advantage, especially if you have a high net worth individual who's looking to preserve capital. You know, they might have an exit or some sort of liquidity event. They're trying to offset those capital gains. If you can do a cost segregation study in year one or two, that's a huge advantage. So yeah, that's awesome. You know, one thing we didn't talk about is kind of the asset class that you guys go after. And are you guys still doing value add type projects during COVID or looking for things that cash flow from day one? Or what's your strategy there?
Yeah. So historically, we were very focused on suburban office. And, you know, we just got our quarterly financials done, actually. And, you know, knock on wood, so far, occupancy and rent collection have been pretty high. Now, obviously, new rent activity or rent renewal activity has been subdued and muted, as you would anticipate. But for the most part, we haven't had any major issues in terms of giving the keys back to a lender. We have had some tenants have some issues, as you can imagine. So that's still our bread and butter. Since COVID occurred, we have not taken down any value add deals. We've been mostly focused on very stable, high quality, income producing, long weighted average lease term, good credit tenancy buildings. We closed one in June, and knock on wood, we're trying to close one here in the next 2 weeks. So COVID obviously was a little bit of a setback, but we've still been active and the investor appetite has still been there. I think at first in Q1, people were just really scared. And then when things started to turn around, you know, people just wanted exposure to other things outside the market. And now I think with, you know, there's a real threat to, in my opinion, inflation on the horizon with what's going on right now. And the market seems to be, you know, disengaged from the real economy. We're getting a lot more activity and traction with our investors that want to, you know, have some diversity, still get that passive income. And then again, all those tax benefits that come along with it.
Sure, sure. Do you foresee your strategy changing at all in the future? Are you worried about more people working from home and that changing kind of the office space landscape?
Sure. So one of the reasons I like being a fundless sponsor is I'm not beholden to what I put into PPM, right? So, you know, if you can imagine, if you're a fund manager and you launch your $100 million fund in January of this year, and you're focused on suburban value add, it's a very challenging period, right? It's going to be a hard time to deploy the capital for 1, 2, 3 years in your deployment window. And it's very hard to go back and change the conditions that allow you to deploy that capital within the PPM, which is the document that governs that fund. I like being a fundless sponsor because I can go where opportunity takes me. And so you know, right now we are looking at some triple net product. We're looking at a actually pretty interesting, a early childhood center franchisee model. It's a Primrose school. There's a lot of them around. We started digging in a lot on that. We actually have one under contract today.
Nice. Congrats.
So we're continuing to be opportunistic. To your question about the future of office, there's a lot of recency bias. And in March and April, people saying that, you know, office is dead, everyone's going to work from home. That wore pretty thin at around Labor Day when, you know, creativity was down, productivity was down, depression was up. People felt isolated and insular, especially if you're a younger person who maybe doesn't have a big house with a separate office and you're just sitting in your apartment staring at the wall. You know, I think the way that we change, the way that we use office will change, right? I'm not sure it'll be 5 days a week every day. At the same time, I think, you know, if you're a manager or an executive, you're going to want some group sessions moving forward. And people, I think for the most part, will want some delineation between their home life and their work life, because right now there's been just a blur and it's all gray area. So I foresee with this vaccine on the horizon, I think a lot of people are going to want to come back to the office. Now, will they want to commute to New York City by taking a train and then a bus and a subway and then taking an elevator up 20 floors? I don't know. But I do think people are going to want that group connectivity, that human connectivity, in order to make sure that they're, you know, being creative, being collaborative. All those things are just difficult to do over Zoom.
It's that time in the show for a segment called Best Deal, Worst Deal, where we talk about real estate transactions that you've done in the past so that others can learn from your knowledge and expertise. So Brian, with that said, what's the best real estate deal that you've done?
We bought an office building in Nashville, gosh, it was probably 5 years ago. And off market, a buddy brought the deal to me. It was, for the most part, fully occupied. It was a converted distribution warehouse in like this up and coming burgeoning submarket in Nashville that had become just its city overnight. We bought it. You know, we did a little bit of leasing work. We took it to from 95 to 100% occupied. We took the weighted average lease term from, call it, 4 years to 8 years, locked some users in for a long period of time. And we bought it at an 8.5 cap. We held it for 2 years. We're able to distribute about a 14% cash on cash return during that time. And then we sold it for about 6.5 cap. So about a 200 basis point cap rate compression. So we hit just this insane IRR. It was over 2x multiple, short hold period. But it was really, I mean, we did some good things, but it was a lot of, it was just dumb luck that we were in Nashville. This group out of Connecticut just desperately wanted to be in town. You know, we engaged with CBRE and we said, hey, throw out an annoying number that would be just, you know, obnoxiously big. And they took it down. I need more deals like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. How much did you raise for that deal?
It was probably something like 3 or 4 million.
Okay.
Lower end of the range for us. But yeah. Probably like 3 million.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. And what would you say is the worst real estate deal that you've done?
Early in my career, I had a partner that is no longer with us. And we did a development deal, urban infill in Nashville. And we had the tenants lined up. It was a good location. But we totally underestimated the impact that this local political race was going to have on development within this neighborhood. And we got caught up in this this terrible election issue where people were against development, not in my backyard type of approach, and ended up having a year worth of pain associated with that deal. We managed to get out even on it, but we didn't make any money. And we spent just an inordinate amount of time and energy to try to, you know, disengage from a deal that should have been good, but it was a nightmare. And so we don't do those type of deals anymore.
Got it. And what did you learn from that deal moving forward?
I just don't have the risk appetite to be a developer.
Mm-hmm.
I can't operate like that. That was a lesson learned.
Awesome. Well, Brian, we're getting a little bit short on time here, but let me just ask one final question. How can an investor work with you? And then do you have a certain type of investor that you prefer to work with? You prefer family offices or individuals, or what's kind of the best relationship when it comes to investing with you?
Yeah, thank you for that question. You can come. I'm very active on LinkedIn. If you look up Brian C. Adams, Excelsior, shoot me a message. I'm happy to chat about anything you want. Or you can go to excelsiorgp.com. You can see our resources page. We put out a lot of content, blog pieces, webinars, and a lot of things that are not real estate related, just topics and issues that are, I think, useful for individuals and families to have in the back of their minds. And you can sign up for our newsletter there as well. In terms of the investor profile, we only work with accredited investors, but there's a very broad spectrum, right? We'll work with an individual or a large family office. It runs the gamut. So, part of the reason I built the infrastructure I have with my controller and some of the things like Juniper Square and other reporting technologies that we have in-house is to be able to manage kind of a larger volume of investors. And so far, it's worked really well. So yeah, I'd encourage anyone interested to reach out directly.
Awesome. Is there a minimum investment with you?
It's interesting. It used to be $100,000 for a new investor. So if I didn't have a relationship with you, that was kind of the minimum. We had protocols in place for friends and family or legacy investors and that kind of thing. But the most recent offering we did, we just lowered it to $10,000. And the response has been very positive. So, we're constantly kind of evaluating what makes sense for the deal, what makes sense for us, what makes sense for the investor community. So I'm not trying to duck the question, but it's a little bit of a moving target because we are experimenting there.
Sure. And where can others go to connect with you and learn more about what you're up to? Is the website the best place?
Yeah, the website or LinkedIn. Just feel free to reach out and you might get your money's worth for my free advice, but I'm happy to give it.
Awesome. Well, Brian, thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate all the insight. Thank you for taking the time and enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Hey, everybody. It's Mark Allen Kenny. If you're interested in apartment building investments, schedule a call with me so we can have a chance to chat. My company is focused on growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. So let's hop on a quick call and talk about your investment goals and see if we're a good fit. Find out more at stellarinvestmentgroup.com.